And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of June 4th, 2020. Today we're joined by our co-host, the author and educator, Ms. Mariah Tinger. How are you doing, Mariah?
I'm okay, Ted. I'm okay. Hanging in there. Okay.
Good, good, good. Well, not surprising that things are a little somber. We have fairly heavy topics to discuss because it's a heavy time in our country. There's a lot of things going on. What we want to talk about are the consequences and implications of the death of Mr. Floyd in Minneapolis. And I would want to begin by extending our condolences and sorrow to the family of Mr. Floyd. Right? I mean, we just begin by saying what a horrible human tragedy has happened. We want to extend our solidarity and support to all the people that are marching, bravely marching, to demand justice in this case. That is, that's a whole week's worth of cable news right there by making reference to that. Right? That's an important thing, but we stand in solidarity with those. Also, in terms of the discussion that we have, I would want to make sure that everyone knows that I have no lived experience for the kind of brutality that we've seen. Mariah, I presume you're in a similar boat, and that we speak with humility and an effort to learn new things about how we should live our lives. Having said that, though, I would like to speak about these things in the sense of taking responsibility for the kinds of injustices that we see that are driven by people who have less risk, right? People like myself should be talking about these topics because it's needed. It's neat. So anyway, so there's all that. I think it's fair to say, Mariah, you can agree that we come to this with a great deal of humility in the discussion of the events that have to do with Black Lives Matter, and beg forgiveness for anything that we say that's uneducated or unwise, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a hard time. It's a hard, I've been teary-eyed several times this week, and I will apologize in advance if I get choked up even just having this podcast. It's, talking to friends and hearing sort of what they have to go through on a day-to-day basis, just being afraid to walk down the street. It's just heart-wrenching.
The predicate for what I think is worth our discussion. Of course, our discussion is going to end up talking about what should climate activists, what lessons should we take from this? What can we learn? This is a learnable moment. What do we need to take out of this terrible time as climate activists? Right? What are the important things that we should know? And that theory that I guess I will push begins with the idea that what happened in Minneapolis was a manifestation of a kind of systemic racism that has been built into this country since its inception. Okay, we've all seen the videos, good cops, bad cops, all that kind of discussions aside, there were four people that were involved in something that looks like it is a part of a system. Okay, and I think that most people who are aware understand that there's a lot of systems that contain racism and that produce harshly unequal circumstances in our country, from educational inequalities, economic inequalities, health inequalities. I mean, look at all the COVID-19 health inequalities that we're experiencing now, right? These fall out of systemic, to the point where no individual human necessarily has to make any decision anymore. It's all built into the system. It's all just going along. And I think two things fall out of that for me, Mariah. One is that climate drivers and responses fit in within that systemic, that sort of a racist systemic system, and it bears analysis. Another point that falls out of this, which I hope to say several times, is the idea that we're all complicit in this systemic racism, and that even though we can pat ourselves on the back and say, oh, I'm not a racist, that's no longer adequate, right? By saying I'm not a racist basically gives a pass to the people who are, because they're still doing stuff, and when you say that about yourself, you basically check out of the conversation. So in a sense, what's called for is anti-racism, actively addressing the causes that are underlying here. Mariah, is that
I mean, there's no question that, you know, there's this entrenched systemic racism, which has led to disproportionate impacts of pollution on communities of color. As you mentioned, it's, you know, COVID-19 is exacerbated because a lot of the pollution that people of color who live in places where there's higher levels of pollution are more likely to die from COVID-19. Thereby, COVID-19 is sort of, because of climate, killing more people in communities of color. And, you know, I think that when you see systems that are broken, there's a confluence of them. This Wes Moore said this on a wonderful interview today on NPR, or rather yesterday on NPR. But there's a confluence where you see these broken systems are collectively destructive on so many other levels, right? So you have broken climate systems where we're sort of abusing the planet and overusing resources and going beyond the limits that the planet can sustain. And, you know, Mary Anais Hegler, who's a just fantastic, inspirational writer. I love her almost every single piece she writes changes me in some profound way. But, you know, she said that we tell ourselves that environmental problems started with the Industrial Revolution, but that's a lie. She says it started with the conquest, genocide, and slavery way, 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 way back. And that's the moment when white man's relationship with living things became extractive and disharmonious. And that has extended into, you know, how we view, the way we have treated people has extended to the way we treat environment. All of this is bundled into just a lack of respect, you know, in general.
And I guess I would go one step farther and say that the climate movement, historically, I mean, I think it's changing now, but historically has been a sort of a white, educated, middle-class movement. And I think it has had a blind spot. And I think that the fossil fuel industry has exploited that. I mean, communities of color often get the refinery because they have the least political clout to oppose it. And again, you mean, here in Boston, there's very well-to-do communities that you could not imagine building a refinery, right, or putting in a natural gas compressor, right? In other communities where you think you can get away with it. And for too long, the climate movement has, I mean, it's just easier to let that pass because there's so many other things going on, and we have kind of have this blind spot without recognizing the inherent underlying systemic racism that allows us to accept those things, right? As I said, I think it's changing now, but in the fossil fuel industry has exploited that blind spot, that sort of soft, unexamined weakness, where you think, well, I would never do that personally. It's let me put that down there.
I agree. I mean, and not just, you know, not only is it, you know, you see these oil refineries being built in places where it's disproportionately affecting people of color. But we've also lost the support of people that that the whole movement needs, right?
Yep.
You know,
yep.
Matthias Lehman, who's the digital director for the Sunrise Movement, said that for a long time before he joined the Sunrise Movement, that he viewed the climate movement as too white, too middle class, often more concerned with trees and polar bears than with you know, what human destruction is doing to black and brown communities around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that was a sort of widespread thing. It was seen, the environmental movement is seen as something for, you know, people that want to hug trees and drive Priuses and do yoga. And of course, you know, that doesn't, you miss, if that's the face of your environmental movement, you're gonna miss a lot of people who, you know, they can't connect with those sorts of things, right? They're more concerned about the fact that their daughter or son can't breathe because of asthma and air pollution and so on and so forth.
There's a quote.
As well, they should be.
There's a quote from the Washington Post that I don't have the reference here in front of me, but the person writes, this is a quote from an article in the Washington Post. We will put it up. It says, here's the rub. If we want to successfully address climate change, we need people of color. Not just because pursuing diversity is a good thing to do, and not even because diversity leads to better decision-making and more effective strategies, but because black people are significantly more concerned about climate change than white people, and Latinx people are even more concerned. To put that in perspective, it means more than 23 million black Americans already care deeply about the environment and could make a huge contribution to the massive amount of climate work that needs to be doing. So, I mean, on top of everything else, there's this political thing where, you know, you want to build your allies, right? You want to be an ally and build allied relationships.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, just to your point, we all remember all the history of the Dakota Access Pipeline, right, through the Standing Rock Reservation in North Dakota. I don't have my geography right, so I could be wrong, but the original map took the pipeline north of, I think it was Bismarck, North Dakota. I could be wrong, but across a major city in North Dakota, across the river. And the people in that town, the mostly white people in that town, rejected that because it might contaminate the water. And so they rerouted the pipeline through the Standing Rock Reservation and crossed the river south of this town, right? A clear example where, you know, white self-interest was, you know, exploited because the person that they, the community they could exploit most easily was the Standing Rock tribe. I mean, just, it keeps happening.
Yeah, it's crushing. It's crushing, and it's...
So I guess the question I think that's before us is, you know, what do climate hawks do? I mean, I think the answer is that the the climate movement, climate activists need to embrace racial justice as a climate issue, because it is a climate issue, because the consequences of climate change are being felt most heavily in communities of color. And that's where the sound of the, you know, that's where the problem is. So we should be helping out there. And that the efforts to do things like reform policing rules and having better education, those strengthen the communities that we want to be strong so that they can resist fossil fuel infrastructure. I mean, it's all of a parcel. I mean, there are so many interlocking reasons why the climate movement should embrace things like the Black Lives Matter movement. Does that make sense, Mariah?
Yeah, and I mean, even to further that, I think that system change that both embraces equality and addresses climate change can lead to a world that I want to live in, right? I don't want to live in this broken world right now. I mean, I do. No issues there. You know?
Thankfully, yeah. I want you here.
But you know, just point being, like, there's so much right now that needs to be changed, that needs to be healed, and addressing both climate change and inequality can heal a lot of those things, and it's important, and they're big fights. And, you know, actually, I'm gonna quote my 6-year-old daughter. She said this the other day, and I thought, you know, that's pretty good. She said, you know, don't stop fighting till the fight is won. Don't stop fighting till the day is done, and don't stop fighting till the war is won. And, you know, that's where we're
that's
at, right?
Good.
We have to fight each battle every day, and there's going to be several of them, and we have to keep after it day after day. And you know, we have to be able to see and hope that eventually this war will be won. We will be able to find ways to address both of these really big problems in a way that reshapes and reforms this earth, our systems in a way that is beautiful for all.
Well, I think that so I've got a quote here. I copied out a bunch of quotes that are for use here, but there's a quote here from Tamara Towles O'Loughlin, who is director of 350.org, North American director of 350.org, right? And what she said was, and I'll put up the link, decades of environmental justice activism have shown that communities facing racist violence and over-policing are also overrun by fossil fuel extraction, pollution, and every manner of related health disparities. The truth is that the status quo is killing us, and so we have no reason to support business as usual. The fight for climate justice must necessarily include challenging the systems of racism that protect profits for the wealthy and destroys black lives. And she goes on to call for the Green New Deal. And, I don't know.
I've heard time and again that the Green New Deal, I've heard it from, you know, many, many different communities, that the Green New Deal it brings people of color into the movement for climate justice. It really does a lot to address, you know, some of these deep-rooted problems. It's a good way to go.
Well,
and voting. Voting.
Well,
right?
Vote, vote, vote. Yes. A friend of ours has said that the five Very most important Steve things Crowley. You can do right now is to vote, 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 vote. But I mean, that brings us to a reasonable place. I mean, you know, what actions could a climate hawk do at this point to embrace racial justice as a climate issue? And I made up a short list based on a bunch of different things that I've seen. One is that people in the climate movement should read black authors, right? And so the gentleman named Ibram Kendi has got a list in the New York Times of 10 good books to read. The first one of which I think is called White Fragility. Right. And if you don't know what white fragility is, Google it. Right. It's a very informative thing that might begin a process of exploration. I think by reading books of people explaining their suffering, it will expand our, and I'm including myself in this, right, expand our perception of ourselves in the world so that you can begin to see yourself in a bigger context. I mean, I think that last summer the New York Times published this 1619 Project, a series of New York Times magazine pieces week after week after week about the black experience. And I mean, of course, 1619, which was the year before the Pilgrims arrived in Plymouth here in Massachusetts, a year before that was the first slave ship that arrived in America. Right? And so, you know, that's a historical fact. The other thing that I think, I say this with humility, I could be wrong, please tell me if I'm wrong. I think that one of the important things for climate activists to do is to talk to other climate activists, shall we say, of privilege, right? And I saw a quotation from Malcolm X, who... I'll just read a quotation, and it says, when Malcolm X was asked how white people could be allies and accomplices with black people in 1964, he responded, by visibly hovering near us, they are proving that they are with us. But the hard truth is that this isn't helping to solve America's racist problem. The Negroes aren't the racists. This is 1964, right? Where the really sincere white people have got to do their proving of themselves is not among the black victims, but out on the battle lines of where American racism really is, and that's in their home communities. America's racism is among their own fellow whites. That's where sincere whites who really mean to accomplish something have got to work. So, I mean, that's 1964, right? I think it rings true today, is that there is not enough to just say, oh, I'm a good person, I would never do that. Right.
Yeah, I think that's really, I think it's really important to make sure that it's clear that the norm that we're shifting it so that, you know, it is no, like, it's no longer okay to act in racist ways. I mean, it never has been, right? But there are communities that think it is, and it has to be so clear that that is becoming, that is a very unacceptable way, right? I mean, and I think, again, we should have been doing this 200 years ago, right? But at the very least, you know, talking every time you can, and it's the same with climate change. Every time you can, anytime you can, talking about these things and making it so that everyone is talking about it in the same ways, is really important for the movement.
And if you're a grassroots climate activist, I mean, there is an opportunity to examine your own organization to find out if it is accepting. If there are elements of the community that you live in that should be included in your work, right? That's just a simple question to ask that an organization could look at, and then that sets you on a path of greater involvement. This is, I hope such things are useful to think about, Mariah. I think what we should do is, well, first of all, I keep speaking for Mariah, but again, I mean, I hope that what we've talked about here is helpful. It is said sincerely with the aim to help. If we've said something that misses the mark, please let us know. Our goal is to promote progress. Right, Mariah? You're nodding.
Yeah. I mean, goodness, we really need to change the world. I mean, so many levels.
This is a deep moment. This is talk about historic moments. Holy mackerel. I mean, how many history books are going to get written about 2020? So what we'll do is we'll put up links to what we've talked about at the blog. It's at massclimateaction.org/blog. If you would like, please send us an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. Let us know what you think. We're here. You can listen to the show on your smartphone using Stitcher, all the major modern podcast distribution apps. If you go to Apple Podcasts, just search for Massachusetts Climate Action and we'll pop up. We want to thank our friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support that provides us with excellent things to think about from week to week. So we're going to close where we always close it by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability. That takes on new meaning. Because we accept responsibility for building a durable future. That takes on some meaning. Because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. We must insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade. And here the important words are, under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon to safeguard our future. So, Mariah, thank you so much for being here for this conversation.
Oh, thank you, Ted. It's an important one.
And again, to everyone listening, we hope that this has been helpful and that it's been constructive. Please let us know if we've missed anything. Thank you so much. Take care. Bye-bye.
Very cool.